different people have got different ideas about what we should do to have a more peaceful world, to have peace in the sense of nations not at war, but also civil peace in communities. And recently, some research has been done that says, well, actually, believe it or not, free markets, that's the way to do it. There's an article written by Indra D'Souza and a colleague, and Indra joins us now. Indra, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, free markets and civil peace, who would have thought it? Not me, I have to say, but it's a very interesting topic. How is it that we've come to this, concluding that free markets have a role in setting the scene for civil peace?
Yes, I mean, this is a very thorny and complex question, but let's suppose that we have a policymaker who is debating whether he should have more free markets, let's say in a post-conflict environment. Should I have more free market policies or less of them? And our research shows very clearly that if you want to avoid things like armed violence, including very violent political dissent that requires, let's say, a political repression, and if you want ethnic peace, all of these done in sort of large data technical analyses, what we find very simply is if you were to place your money on a bet, then the better bet would be to have more free market policies. And the theoretical reasons for why that is true are many, and it comes down from the time of Adam Smith and the debates that has spurned since then, including Marx's critique.
Mm. So why is it that freer markets, what are the sorts of things that you find associated with freer markets that bring us round to that?
So the first answer is a kind of a social capital effect. When people are meaningfully connected in economic activity, for example, a group of merchants would naturally have a high premium on peace because violence would simply be bad for business. In the same way that a group of merchants in a neighborhood will organize to cauterize petty theft or crime so that their businesses are able to do business without disruption. So that's a very simple argument. In a macro sense, it's a hard thing to maintain because we do know that criminals do exist and do break into houses, and we need large police forces to police these things. And we know that they can't guarantee a crime-free environment 100% of the time. So that's a very large, broad argument that people acting in self-interest will bring about a strong element of cooperation in self-interest, will bring about social harmony and so on. So they will overcome collective action problems. Now, I hate to use jargon from social science, but collective action is simply that most people engaged in a collective endeavor like bringing peace, and peace is a public good. That is, you can't exclude people from peace. I cannot pay my share for peace, but simply enjoy it because other people have spent a lot or borne all the costs of bringing about peace. So in those situations, you'll have a lot of people who will free ride on peaceful situations, even try to capitalize on non-peaceful situations for own individual gain. So when we think about market economies, we think about people coming together in a community. That is, there is buildup of social capital among, say, merchants, among consumers, and so on to bring about peace, or even neighborhoods, because we know that violence will be dangerous. But somebody has to bear that cost, and that cost can be borne by people who are engaged in meaningful economic activity, so collective action problems can be overcome. That's a kind of a very macro perspective. The micro perspective we've laid out in our papers come from a lot of research that have gone in trying to understand conflict in general. So one major understanding from that literature that is quite widely accepted now is that simple grievances among people don't lead to conflict, precisely because of those collective action problems that we have talked about. So, for example, in North Korea, where we would expect starving people to be out on the street and protesting their government's policies, that's not going to happen because the costs of doing so will be extremely high for those people who try it. And so people will simply free ride and wait for others to try to solve their collective dilemmas. But places like India, where there is a semblance of democracy and transparency of government and other things, you will have quite a bit of violence in neighborhoods, you'll have criminality, you will have also organized armed violence. Now, that is for reasons other than whether there are more capitalist policies or less, right? This is simply a question of state capacity. But so to get back to the question itself, we have come to understand that simple grievances alone do not make violence viable. That is, it's not feasible. Grievances alone don't simply make large-scale violence, which is costly to all. So violence comes from very narrowly based, opportunistic kind of reasons. Somebody's got to organize it. Somebody's got to profit from it, not necessarily in terms of big bank accounts, but let's say for revenge. Somebody may organize violence against a state for revenge, but that's a very private good. It's not widely shared or publicly supported or widely supported. So in those conditions, violence is very narrowly organized, and we need to understand those narrow bases of organizational advantages of some to make it unpleasant for the many. And this is where violence comes from. Guns, money, infrastructure, what we call in our paper rebellion-specific capital.
Yeah. Well, when there's a freer economy, is it correct to say there's less likely to be shadow economies? And it's that in the shadow economies where these people are more likely to be able to get their resources.
That is right. And in your broad, if you have a repressive economy, then what happens is simply a lot of profitable economic activity simply ends up in the shadows. The best example of this is bootlegging in the 1920s in the United States, which led to the big barons like Al Capone and others, who brought a lot of violence onto the streets of places like Chicago. And this is very similar, the same thing, in terms of a $200 billion drug economy, underground drug economy in the world, which is barely affected by all the resources that governments around the world try to.
Yeah. Is it the case that really the self-interest of having a business, getting some money, being able to look after your kids, and getting the opportunity to experience that brings about a common interest, because you all need peace to be there in order to prosper? It's not only that you don't want, you know, local hoods thieving from your business. You want mums and dads and kids to feel free to walk the streets and come and buy your things or your services. So operating free markets out in the open actually encourages a very wide group of people in their self-interest to promote the common interest.
Yes. And when I say free markets, some people might misunderstand and think, you know, just an open economy. That's not it. In fact, it's much more salient to talk about it as capitalism, as we know it, as classic liberalism would identify. And this is very strong property rights regime upheld by the rule of law, which is where people have proprietary rights, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just simply saying that I want my neighborhood clean, but there is a difference between whether you own the property in the neighborhood or whether you're simply renting from the man, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we talk about property rights, we talk about less market intervention in the economy, because if there's more intervention by governments in the economy, that means there's less property rights floating around in terms of, let's say, the size of GDP of a state or the total wealth produced or so on. So what we are saying is markets that are the least likely to provide very high profits for shadow activity. So think about the Israeli policy of the embargo on the Gaza. The embargo is a kind of unnatural economic repression. Now, there are lots of governments in the world that have economic policies that actually act as embargoes, right?
Yeah.
So you're not allowed to open a business in this particular area because there's a monopoly for the general or the president's son or whatever, right? And so if you think of the embargo, about 99.9% of the tunnels between the Gaza and Egypt are built for simply bringing consumer goods into the Gaza. And because these tunnels are very profitable, it is just an open highway for all the people who would otherwise use it for purposes outside of economic activity to bring in arms and all those other things. So in reality, our advice to the Israeli government would be, don't expend your political capital by having to go into the Gaza every time rockets are fired or whatever. If you really want to close those tunnels, open the market into Egypt, because the legitimate business actors in the Gaza would get those tunnels closed, because now there is no high premium on bringing, let's say, a washing machine or a car, which actually come through those tunnels. So the price of a Hyundai in the Gaza is actually like the price of buying a Porsche in any other Western capital in Europe.
Mamma mia.
Yeah, so imagine what people can earn, because the cost of apparently maintaining a tunnel is something like $70,000 a month. But you can make $70,000 just by bringing one car in, right?
Yeah, and so you will.
Kind of like the drug trade in northern Mexico, you see. It is extremely profitable for people to organize violence and survive in the face of superior state forces. And that is what explains long-term drawn-out violence much better than does, let's say, a hunger riot where people simply raid a food store and go back home and that's it. But how do you explain a long drawn-out conflict in which a lot of people die, like the ones in the Congo, like the ones we witnessed in places like Sri Lanka many parts of Africa and so on, and the ones raging in India between the so-called Maoist rebels and the Indian state? So no amount of good governance or good laws, if they are only politically targeted, are likely to bring you peace benefits. But I am saying, let's start looking far more at the organizational basis of violence, where violence becomes feasible and viable because it can be sustained by relevant revenue streams. That is, you know, not the 5 rupee profits, but the super profits that allow you to organize against superior state forces.
Yeah. Well, now, I just would like to ask something from your article that I understood the substance of what you wanted to say, but not how you got to this conclusion. It's right. Where you point out that in real world terms, the magnitude of the effect of economic freedom on the risk of civil war is really strong. And you say that if everything else stays the same, raising economic freedom alone by what you call one standard deviation above its mean value will have, in the model you've produced, reduced the risk of civil war by 375%. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's tremendous.
So, of course, nothing remains the same in the real world. A lot of these variables have an impact on each other.
Let me say there'll be lots of variables, a bit like pickup sticks, I understand that. But nonetheless, your study shows that if all the other things remain the same, and you go up one standard deviation point, and you and I don't even need to know what that means. What does one standard?
If you're an average guy, what happens if you go up to be a little bit less average? Right.
Yeah. So put all the details aside. If you lift economic freedom, it will have a dramatic effect on the risk of civil war. That's the shortest form we could put it in, isn't it?
That's correct.
Well, that's a good thing, you know.
And we find impressive is that the effect of economic freedom is far greater than the impact of a similar change in per capita income. And of course, good policies are far easier to make that also affect your income possibilities. Good policies are far easier to make than getting wealthy, you see, because a lot of other factors matter. Yeah. So that's very good news for policymakers. You don't really have to wait till you get rich, but you can implement those policies that will also help you get rich, and in the meantime, not have to sacrifice the risk of conflict.
Well, Indra, I found this a very interesting article. A few bits were a little bit technical in terms of the data, but as we've discussed, you don't need to go to the detail of the data. You don't need to understand how the engine works. All you need to understand is what the conclusions in fact mean. Now, So I want to thank you for the article and thank you for joining us, but I did think I heard a chicken in the background during this interview. Thank you somewhere where I would be able to hear a chicken in the background?
No, it's probably a bird. I'm in Sri Lanka at the moment, and we do have lots of lovely birds on the trees here. Much like Australia, the little bit I saw of Australia, you have the cockatoos, I believe.
Well, Indra, it's been very kind of you to join us. The line's been very clear. I think it's a great article, really worth policymakers focusing on this and recognising that it isn't a whole lot of laws you can pass that won't necessarily bring peace, and making people richer won't necessarily bring peace. But
thank you,
setting up the institutional arrangements for free markets just might make a contribution. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Via Skype, that was Indra De Soysa, and he's Professor of Political Science at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. And the report he co-authored is called Free Markets and Civil Peace, and it was published by the Fraser Institute. And yes, we'll put a link to it on our website. You're on RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.